Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Sir Terry Wogan. A pillar of broadcasting, he has, for more than 40 years, made an art and a platinum-plated career out of just chatting. The man who put the wit in wittering, he's been our companion through thousands of on-air hours. In early mornings with his hit Radio 2 show, on primetime TV with his chat show Wogan, the Eurovision Song Contest and Blankety Blank, and not least, as the beating heart of the multi-million pound fundraising extravaganza that is Children in Need. He's done it all with an easy warmth, wry self-mockery, and the ability that every broadcaster craves, a deep connection with his audience. Typically downplaying his talent, he says, "My whole life has been about making it up as I go along." Happy New Year, Sir Terry.
Thank you. That's very kind. I hardly recognise myself from your description there. How enormously flattering. Oh, I'm glad I came to the Desert Island.
Yes, I'm glad you came too. You were part of the Radio 2 breakfast show, of course, at the centre of it for more than 25 years. 2 years since you've given it up. Is it a space that's been hard to fill?
No, as I've often said, I'm a very shallow person. So I can move from one thing to another without thinking too much about it. I miss the interplay with my listeners. Because every morning I would come in, I'd have about 300, 400, 500 emails. And really, they were my material. I've never rehearsed for anything. And so I would come in, the producer would throw these 500 emails at me. I'd open the microphone and start.
What about the team that you worked with? Deadly Alan Coates and the Totty from Splotty and all the rest of them. Don't you miss them?
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. You have to create a kind of little club, if you like. Mm. Because, of course, what we do, we're not talking to an audience. You're talking to one person. And they're only half listening anyway. You have to remember that. You know, they're walking in and out of the kitchen or they're in the car. And so you only have their attention for a very short space of time. And it's a mistake to think that everybody's clinging to your every word.
There are only a handful of people, of course, who are truly household names. How have you dealt with the fame, the knowing that every time you walk out the front door, the people who see you met Terry Wogan today? Have you a sort of carapace to deal with the notoriety, to always have to have a kind word, to be nice to a taxi driver, to talk to the woman in the newsagents, all that stuff?
It shouldn't feel like a carapace. Mm. It should be within your heart to be nice to people. After all, if they're being nice to you, if they're being rude to you, it's a different kind of thing. You don't give them the time of day. I remember early on in my career, I'm walking down Carnaby Street for reasons that escape me. And a fella...
Going for some nice loon pants, maybe.
Yes, those purple loons. Such a feature of my early years. And a voice said, hello. And so I turned. He said, sign this, will you? It's for my wife. I can't bear you myself. And it's important to remember that the more people like you, the more others will despise you. But one of the reasons that I hope I was able to cope with my newfound fame in Britain was that I had been famous before in Ireland, because I started as a newsreader announcer on RTE, and then television started, Irish television, 1961, and I became one of the first faces on it. And it meant that I understood that I could no longer go to pubs, and I understood that people would shout abuse at me in the street. Oh,
there's Terry Wogan. Oh, isn't he very fat?
Let's have some music, Terry Wogan. What are we going to hear first off today?
Well, I thought this one would be a nice one to start with. It's from Babe the Pig in the City, which is an unremarkable follow-up to Babe the Pig. But the little theme tune is absolutely fantastic because it's got everything. It's got Paddy Maloney on the Ilion Pipes, it's got the Black Dyke Mills Band, and it's got Peter Gabriel, and it's got a sentiment that I'd like to be associated with.
Kind and steady heart, he sure to see. much right now, but it'll do. It'll do. When you find yourself in the middle of a storm and you're tired and cold and wet.
That was Peter Gabriel and That'll Do. So, Sir Terry Wogan, most of the broadcasting that you've done over the years, apart from things obviously like Blankety Blank, but obviously much of the radio you've done, plenty of the TV, Eurovision and so on, have been live. Has there been any part of you that just as the green light flashes has felt a sort of shiver of nerves, or did you get well past that?
Yeah, you have to get past it. Television isn't easy, for instance. Radio, I've always found easy. Although my very first broadcast was the Cattle Market Report.
Ah, yes.
And I remember when you start broadcasting first, you lose control, you forget to breathe.
Yeah.
And so I felt as if the roof was coming down on top of me. That was the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done in my life. Subsequently then, as I say, Irish television started, and you'd need a backbone of tungsten to endure and survive that, because nobody knew what they were doing. There were a lot of chances came across from places like Australia, and indeed Blighty, who said that they were directors and producers, and in fact were scene shifters and studio sweepers. It was very nerve-wracking. And so it took me quite a while to get the same kind of confidence on television that I had on radio. And I suppose it didn't really happen for me until I did Blankety Blank.
It is frustrating but inevitably true that more than your triumphs, and there have been many, you will be remembered for your notable disasters. I'm not thinking of you being a disaster, but I'm thinking of your interviewees. You did interview Mel Brooks brilliantly, a lot of verbal sparring and great to watch, and he recommended to you that it would be a very good idea to interview his wife, the great actress Anne Bancroft. She indeed came on your show, and I remember watching it live. I've never, ever seen anything like it. Can you recreate a little moment from that interview?
The thing about Wogan was that it was live. Very few people have risked that. Probably having watched Wogan, they thought, let's not do that again. And because it was live, you took your chances. I mean, I would find myself sitting opposite people and thinking, what are you doing on this show if you're not prepared to talk? And she had that in spades. And so she sat down beside me and she appeared to be in a kind of catatonic trance.
Bearing in mind that she is the late Anne Bancroft, was she medicated? I mean, was there something
no,
wrong?
No, not at all. It was...
She just didn't like you?
Well, I find that very hard to believe myself. Obviously, nobody had told her that it was going to be live. And so she came on, stricken with fear, really. I like to think that's what it was, rather than just a hatred of me.
Right.
But you might be right. The thing about it is, when you get an interview like that, and I got plenty like that because it was live, there was no room for editing. When you get an interview like that, your questions become longer.
Indeed, to fill the gaps, yes.
And their responses become monosyllabic.
Well, if you got less than you expected from Anne Bancroft, you surely got more than you expected from David Icke in 1991. He appeared at that time. He was, I think, a member of the Green Party. He was a very well-known sports broadcaster. He came on in, I think it was a turquoise shell suit. And he proclaimed himself in front of you and your audience to be, I think I'm right, the Son of God.
Yes, indeed. And maybe something in what he said. The thing, when you do a talk show, chat show, or in Dutch, prat show.
How interesting.
Yes, and suitable. What you're remembered for is not your good interviews.
No.
I mean, dear old Parky's remembered for being attacked by the emu.
Yeah.
And Russell being hit by Grace Jones.
Yes.
And me, I'm remembered for George Best being drunk and for David Icke being the Son of God. And I did a little series for Satellite called Wogan Now and Then when we brought back people. He came back and he was determined to get his own back on me.
So when you got him back in the chair, were you nervous second time around to be interviewing David Icke?
No, my nerves went a long time ago with me in terms of television.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear? Disc number two.
I thought maybe you'd like... I like it. It's all subjective, isn't it?
It is.
But this is a classic song by possibly the greatest interpreter of the popular song.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable.
That was Frank Sinatra and My Funny Valentine. I wonder then, what does Helen make of it when you come home from an interview like that from the David Icke's and the Anne Bancrofts? What do you say to her when you walk in the door?
Nothing, because I never bring it home. And she'll occasionally comment. But she knows me. I've just done it live because I want to get home and have my dinner and live a normal life. That's what keeps you sane. If you have a core, that is the most important thing in your life, which is my family.
Is it true that you are actually a little bit shy, that socially Helen is the one who organises everything?
She's a cohesive kind of person. She's more gregarious than me. She's a lot of what she euphemistically calls girlfriends. And I'm known as Terry No Mates. Because the nature of what we do, when you work in radio, the idea that we're all part of a jolly, happy family huddling together for warmth is not true. I would come in the early morning in Radio 2 and I'd see the back of Sarah Kennedy's head. And then, just before I finished, I'd see the front of Ken Bruce, maybe not his best side. And that was it. But as far as shyness goes, yeah, I've always... There's nothing wrong with being shy. Shy is good.
Now, is it the case that the Dawes shop still exists in Limerick?
It does.
Your dad's shop still there?
It is. The brother and I, he came down from Dublin, my brother Brian, and we walked around the Dawes old shop trying to identify where the bacon slicer used to be. It was lovely to go back to see my friends who I'd left nearly 60 years ago. And there they were.
Were they? Yes.
Yeah. Very old. I didn't understand that. But they were still the same. And it's the same when I go back to reunions in Belvedere, which is my school in Dublin. Nobody has changed, except on the outside. The people who are comedians are still comedians. The people who took life seriously are still... The Egypts are still Egypts. And I think you sort of... When you're 17, you're fully formed, really, in the person that you're going to be. But the Dar, anyway, was manager. He'd met my mother in Grafton Street, in Dublin, when they both worked in Leverton Fry, Grafton Street, which was kind of Fortnum and Mason, sort of rather grand. And the reason they got married was that he was offered the managership of Limerick, otherwise he couldn't possibly have afforded it. And then subsequently, his talents and his hard work caused him to be the general manager and the director, and we all moved up to Dublin.
And what are your earliest memories of Limerick then? What sort of place was it to live?
Limerick has always been an individual city. It's on the Shannon. It has docks. So it was semi-industrial and a tough town and the home of Irish rugby. Yeah, I left Limerick when I was 15.
Right.
Left a load of my friends behind. Then when I left Dublin to come here, I left some more of my friends behind. So there I am, Terry No Mates.
Let's have some more music, Terry No Mates. What's next?
This is from Sleepless in Seattle. And this is Carly Simon, who's one of my favourite singers. She could be a mezzo, she could be a contralto, but she's got long legs. And she sings this lovely song.
When the sun is high in the afternoon sky, you can always find something to do. But from dusk till dawn, as the clock ticks on, something happens to you. In the wee small hours of the morning.
Carly Simon and Wee Small Hours. Sir Terry, you have a younger brother, as you mentioned, but for 6 years you were an only child. Were you doted upon?
I suppose so. Not so much by my parents, but I was doted upon when my mother would take me back to Dublin, where her heart really was. And my mother would take me up to my maiden aunts. And I had a great aunt Mag, who was also a maiden aunt. So I had my Auntie May, who is my godmother, Auntie Nellie, and Auntie Kitty. And yeah, I suppose my Auntie May spoiled me a bit. My Auntie May was the one who got me reading, because she was the manageress of a bookstore in Dublin. And every week she would send me the comics. And then every couple of weeks she'd send me a book.
Where was religion in your upbringing? Was that important?
It was in my upbringing, certainly. Mm. Although my mother and father were never as devout as their neighbours and their friends, certainly in Limerick. When I met the present Lady Wogan, we went to see her parents, and they, every evening, said the family rosary, which came as something as a shock to me, I can tell you.
And what about this Jesuit schoolboy upbringing. I can't imagine it made you overly confident with the girls.
Well, no, you never. I don't know how anybody came out of an Irish education of my era with any kind of self-esteem at all, because apart from sex, the worst sin of all was vanity. And indeed, rugby, which I played a great deal of. There is no I in team. So, you know, you might score a try, in my case, very rarely, and then come running back to the halfway line, almost shamefaced. And if it was a rather good try, the captain might say, well done.
Now, I like rugby. I'm quite interested in rugby, but I'm also interested in the sex bit. I'm interested in what, you know, being ashamed, this idea that, you know...
You weren't ashamed. We weren't ashamed of it. We just didn't know about it. It was in its infancy in Ireland. There were girls, of course. And indeed, there was a certain amount of enlightenment because the Jesuits, and certainly in Limerick, every so often, maybe once a year, they'd have a dance. And the girls from the local convent would be invited. And then we would dance with the priests and the nuns circling us. So that was fairly enlightened for those times.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear? We're on your fourth choice.
Well, one of the things about doing the Eurovision was I got to see a lot of Europe. And we went to St. Petersburg, Helen and I, before we went on to Belgrade for the Eurovision Song Contest there. And we walked into this wonderful church and this magnificent Russian bass voice rang out, and it was one of the priests. And I love the bass voice. So I just thought a little piece of the choir of Moscow's Church of the Ascension. This would remind me of happy days in St. Petersburg.
The choir of Moscow's Church of the Ascension of the Lord, and O Praise the Lord from Heaven. So, Terry Wogan, you've been married to Helen, who you've mentioned often so far, for 45 years.
46?
46, I've
got your pardon. Gosh, watch your step. She could be listening to this.
How did you meet?
Someone chanted evening across a crowded room. And it was a party in Dublin. And she'd been let down by a boyfriend, which I find very extraordinary. And I had come from reading the news on the television in Ireland. And she was well known in Ireland for being very beautiful and for being a famous model and working for American Vogue and in Paris and all the rest of it. And I'd seen her on stage because she did a little bit of acting as well. And subsequently, then, I gave her a lift home in my Morris Minor with the broken passenger seat.
Your smoothie.
Uh-huh. We went off and had some soup and sandwiches. I know how to get round girls.
So how did you manage to win her heart?
Well, easy. She always says I took her off the shelf. I've always said that she was Ireland's luckiest woman. That's our little standing joke. We know it's not true.
Indeed.
And
I've seen the photographs. I mean, stunningly beautiful. As you say, she had a proper... This was not a little local girl doing a bit of modelling. She had a proper, full-blown, very successful international career.
Yes. And she was very beautiful. But she was also extraordinarily nice and kind. See, I think the most important thing in life is kindness. The great thing about Helen and the thing that caused me to take her to my heart was that she was always the same to everybody. There is no act. There is no affectation. There is no chameleon there that will change to be something different depending on the mood. She is the epitome of goodness, really. A mother had that extraordinary quality of living this life but never thinking that this was it. that the next life was the thing that was important. Helen's not that religious, but she still has the faith, obviously.
You've said that the church is not that important to you. Was there a specific point at which you sort of lost your religion and decided that really it didn't have much to offer?
Well, I'm brought up by Jesuits who were very clever men. So my mother always said it was the Jesuits' fault that I didn't believe because they made me think. And you see, that's the point. The gift of faith is that at some point you stop thinking. You say, OK, I accept this. And I accept this gift of faith. And it's a wonderful gift. It's a great consolation to everybody. I've never had that gift. Well, I had, of course, for a while. But I'd always questioned it, really. I personally believe in people. I suppose you could call a humanist, I don't know. But I'd rather think that we're born good rather than evil. I've never accepted the concept of original sin.
You have three grown-up children now. Very sadly, you and Helen, at the beginning of your marriage, lost a young daughter, and I'm wondering if that might, for the people who've been through such a profoundly painful experience, that can be a moment.
Yes.
When they part company from their faith.
Yes, I wouldn't say it was the moment, but it's a cumulative factor, yes. You think this is not fair, and of course it happens to people all the time, and it's not just you, and you shouldn't be so silly, but... Yeah, that did have a mark, leave its mark on me.
Do you think it also, given it's so interesting and it sounds central to your entire existence, your wife and your family, do you think that cemented that also, that sense that above all else, whatever is happening in the ridiculously unpredictable world of your career, the family's the thing?
Oh, yeah, well, that is exactly what it is. Whether it was because we lost our daughter, I doubt it. We're an Irish family. Irish families are like that. My children come to us every weekend or so, not all of them together, but in dribs and drabs they bring their children. And it's the only important thing in life.
Let's have some music. What's next?
This is Una Furtiva Lagrima from Donizetti's L'Elisir d'Amore. Music is a wonderful thing for memory, isn't it? The minute I hear this, I get a mental picture of sitting in the Staatsoper in Vienna a couple of years ago and L'Elisir d'Amore being performed and this wonderful song from it.
Placido Domingo singing Una Furtiva Lagrima, a single secret tear from Donizetti's L'Elisir d'Amore with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by John Pritchard. Let's go then, Sir Terry Wogan, to the end of the 1960s. You moved to Britain for work. Was that a tough decision to leave Ireland?
No. It's the kind of decision you take when you're young and fearless. I'd started to work for the BBC while I was still an announcer on Irish radio, and publicity photographs came out, famous photographs in 1967 of us all sitting outside the church.
Yes.
All the pirates.
John Peel and so on, everybody
yeah,
there. Yes.
All the pirates. And Jimmy Young and myself, the two people in suits.
Were you the only two in suits?
Exactly. Well, no, Bob Holness had a suit as well.
Right.
And when I got back, the Director General of Irish Radio and Television asked to see me. We had a little conversation. And it turned out that he didn't feel that I could continue to work for the BBC while being paid employee of Radio Televisieren. So I resigned and then sent a tape to the BBC to a man called Mark White. He was assistant head of gramophone department.
The tape that you sent him, is it true it was spooled the wrong way round?
It was, yeah. I hadn't rewound it. He puts it the right way round. He listens to it and he offers me a job.
It's important to remember that you were doing the Radio 2 breakfast show, you know, the most prominent show on the station, throughout the years when the IRA's bombing campaign was at its height. Did you feel your Irishness more keenly than ever?
Yeah, I never obviously denied my nationality. I never apologised for it. Certainly what was being done was not being done in my name.
Of course.
It was very difficult. I was very conscious, for instance. You'd come up a cheery morning voice after some horrific bomb incident. Being in the privileged position I was in, I never came across any antipathy. And years later, Irish people who'd lived in Britain as long as me, maybe even longer, came up to me and said that they were grateful to me for being an Irish voice without apology.
Is it the case that you were sent a parcel bomb addressed to you at Broadcasting House in 1994, I think it was?
It was. And my producer carried this parcel to the post room and was roundly castigated by the BBC, nearly lost his job for trying to blow himself up. And the thing was that whoever sent in the bomb with my name on it couldn't have been much of a fan because I was on holiday.
Was it actually a bomb?
Yeah, it was a device.
So it had to be defused and goodness me.
Yeah.
Through that time then, working on The Breakfast Show, of course, would be the time when you had a young family growing up. Were you a very modern dad then? Because I presumed it would give you the hours to be able to pick them up from school.
That's the great thing. I had the best of both worlds. I was able to escape in the early morning, which is the most traumatic time for any family. And then I had the rather gentlemanly job of picking them up from school in the afternoon.
You jammy
sword. Oh, it was fantastic. Great. It's no wonder I'm such a family man.
Let's have some more music, Terry. Next is what?
Well, I thought, again, this is from the soundtrack of a movie that I challenge anybody to watch without bursting into uncontrollable tears, Sleepless in Seattle. And this is my favourite version of this song. It's Jimmy Durante, As Time Goes By.
And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you, and that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by.
That was Jimmy Durante and As Time Goes By. It is quite a sentimental list, this, Terry Wogan. Are you a sentimental character?
It is heartstring-tugging time, isn't it? I'm playing on the emotions of the listener, although Radio 4 listeners, I'm not sure about their hearts.
When you were gearing up then to leave your breakfast show, you said there's never a good time to leave, but there is a right time. How do you know when the right time is?
I've always been the kind of person who left parties early. My mother used to say of me that I'd go out and play with the kids, but I wouldn't leave when everybody was there. I'd make my own time to leave. I do believe in our business that you shouldn't outstay your welcome. My regret is that I didn't stop doing Wogan, the talk show, about a year before. But no, we need to carry on, they said, because it's 150 hours of broadcasting on the television, and we need you to go on. Meantime, they were building a village in Spain for another sitcom.
Yes, for the ill-fated...
El Dorado.
Yes, well, it was a bit of a sitcom. I think it was meant to be a soap opera. Yeah. You then found out how. What, they just came to you and said, it's all over.
Yeah. They broke it to me gently. It's the thing the BBC's not awfully good at. I always think that sometimes things end badly because nobody ever says to an artiste, look, we'll have another year and then with all sorts of trumpets blaring, you'll go. But they don't, they're not very good at that. Confrontation is not a great BBC thing.
And just as well you're steely then in your backbone.
You have to be, yeah. A little bit. And you also have to, as I say, impose your own timing. BBC is a corporation, it's not your granny. I mean, it's the greatest broadcasting organisation in the world. It will be a terrible shame if it's undermined in this country because, as Michael Grader said, it's the BBC that keeps everybody else straight.
Here we are with Sir Bruce Forsyth, who makes you seem like a mere stripling. He's in his mid-80s.
But look at him. I mean, dainty on the feet.
Yes.
Fit as a flea.
Indeed.
He'll go on forever.
Yes. So...
I won't go on forever. I'll fold my tent and silently steal away one of these days.
Let's have some music on our penultimate disc of the morning. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Gretchen Peters, who's a singer-songwriter, like so many brilliant singer-songwriters, from Nashville, which seems to produce them like the Welsh produce Fly Halves. Of course I'm going to be accused of excessive sentimentality and heartstring tugging, but this is such an affecting song. It's called When You Are Old.
When you are old, full of sleep, and death no longer makes you weep, when your body aches with cold, I'll warm your heart when you are old.
Gretchen Peters and When You Are Old. Let's talk, Terry Wogan, about the togs, Terry's old geezers and gals. In your autobiography, you've included a list, a sort of togs checklist of the characteristics. Take us through a few, would you?
The togs, of course, are Terry's old geezers and gals, as you know, and they have a life of their own now. I go to togs conventions, and we all meet, and they dance and behave disgracefully. And so do I. How do you qualify as
a
tog?
Yes, how do you know if you're a tog?
Well, you're asleep, but others worry that you're dead. You're proud of your lawnmower. The end of your tie doesn't come anywhere near the top of your pants. You see Time Team on the television and get drawn in. You can live without sex, but not without glasses.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, you say there are togs conventions. Do they still have them now that you're not on the radio?
Oh, yeah, I was there this year, yes.
Right, so your relationship with your fans then is a very... It seems like a personal one. It exists apart from the programme.
Oh, absolutely. I obviously still try and keep it going every Sunday on Weekend Wogan. But they're the ones. They're the people who keep me going. They're the people whose wit and wisdom and the ability to take ideas laterally rather than vertically. That strange sense of humour.
What do they expect from you, I wonder?
Nothing, really. They turn up to everything I do. We still have, I hope, an enormous affection for each other. I miss them in a sense, and I know they miss me, being there every morning.
You have a lovely little brood of grandchildren. How many do you have?
I have five now.
Ah.
I have five, two girls and three boys, and the eldest is seven. My children let me down a little bit by marrying a bit later than I did. I want to be around when the grandchildren go to university, and I may not be around when they get married, but, you know, I'd like to be there when they grow up.
So the island, Sir Terry. Off you go. I'm going to cast you away. How will you be on your own on the island?
I'll be all right, because I was an only child for about nearly 7 years. I won't be able to put up a house or anything. I'm absolutely hopeless, completely unhandy. My wife changes the plugs in our house.
Our final disc, then. What are we going to hear?
Well, I'm very fond of opera. I'm involved with the Garsington Opera. And when I was a lad, I used to go to the Dublin Grand Opera Societies, and I was a super, an extra. And so I was an Assyrian slave, I was a doge in Venice, I was a waiter in La Traviata, just to get in to see the old operas. This strikes a responsive chord because I remember it being sung in that wonderful old Roman Colosseum in Verona, the great tenor aria from Tosca, called E Luce Van Le Stelle.
Placido Domingo singing E Luce Van La Stelle and the Stars Would Be Shining from Puccini's Tosca with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Giuseppe Sinopoli. So, I'm going to give you the books, Sir Terry Wogan. The Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare and you can take another book.
I thought I'd pick a book which many people think is the greatest book ever written, but War and Peace. I've made several attempts, and I've never got past page 220.
Right.
So if I'm on the old desert island, I'll give it a real go.
Right, I shall give that to you. And, of course, you know you're allowed a luxury, too. Mm. What will your luxury be?
I want plenty of empty bottles. Or maybe full bottles that I could empty.
Right, full bottles of what?
Vodka, wine, whiskey.
A variety, a full bar.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll supply you with a full bar.
A full bar. That would be very nice, and then I would empty them. And give me plenty of paper. Not only could I attempt to write the great novel, but I could also write messages, which I would stick in the empty bottles, like, get me out of here before I die of starvation, privation, or exposure.
It's almost too practical, but I have a feeling that they would just end up being washed back on the shore. So on that basis, I think it's New Year's Day. I'm feeling generous. I shall let you have the bottles full and the bits of paper and pens to work on your novel. And if you had to choose just one of these eight tracks, which one track would you save?
I think I'd probably choose the first one, simply because it kind of epitomises my attitude, which is that the only thing that really matters in the world is kindness.
Right,
so Peter Gabriel and That'll Do.
Sir Terry Wogan, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.